And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I am Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague Stuart Mandel. And Stu, we have a really good show today. We're going to be joined by our friend Bucky Brooks, who is a scouting whiz, who former NFL scout, former NFL player, who's got a lot of insight on a lot of things, and I think our listeners will enjoy hearing from him. But let's say maybe take the pulse of where we feel like we're at with everything that's going on around the country, and certainly as it relates to college football. How confident are you, Stu, that everything's going to start on time?
You know, it's definitely been a rough couple weeks in that department. When COVID first hit, I think we were all, very, everything was up in the air. You didn't quite know what to make of everything yet, but everybody just kept saying, well, we've got time, right? We've got 4 months, 5 months, whatever it was, until the football season. We'll know a lot more. So you just kind of put that on the back burner. And then when the numbers started to go down across the country, and then certainly when college football teams felt comfortable to have their athletes come back and start training, I frankly kind of put it aside. Like, yeah, we're going to have a college football season. Let's do this. And then obviously things have taken a turn for the worse. I mean, first you had some pretty, alarming numbers of players testing positive at certain schools, but now it's not just football, right? The whole country we're seeing. I think the numbers have almost doubled in the last 2 weeks. Certainly some states, Arizona, Texas, Florida, it's really, really rough right now. I increasingly feel like, I feel like we're running out of time, right? Like, there still is time for this thing to reverse itself again and for us to learn more about the virus. And so far, I mean, the encouraging thing is that so far, yes, there are players testing positive, but we have yet to hear of a single case of a player having to be hospitalized. It seems like most of them are asymptomatic. And I think that there's a certain contingent of college athletics that just feels like, well, that's just how it's going to have to be. There's going to be positive tests. Players are going to miss games, but we'll make it through the season. I think what's troubling to me is that this wave, this spike, if you will, we're seeing is tied pretty closely to, I mean, we've seen how many instances now we've heard of, like, the players aren't getting testing positive because they're working out together. It's because they're going to parties or bars or hanging out in people's dorms. And I'm just getting increasingly nervous about universities coming back in the fall. Even if you can, put yourself in a bubble and have good protocols around the football building, what's going to happen when there's 30, 40,000 students back on campus? There was a story just this week about how the authorities discovered that some Alabama students who knew they were positive were going out to parties and infecting other people. Stuff like that really makes you pause and say, how are we going to do this?
Yeah, one of the things that I heard this week was from an AD at a big school who had said to me, one of the challenges is a lot of 18 to 22 year olds aren't taking this seriously enough. And that has been a frustration. And look, I think it's not just that. I think there's a bunch of people who probably haven't. I would say, and this is the way I've kind of categorized my feelings on whether we're going to have a season on time or not, is I am more optimistic than I was probably 3 months ago, but less optimistic than I was 2 weeks ago. And we'll see. I mean, and I think this would fit maybe into the category of a red herring, but as I'll say it and tell me what you think. So as we're taping this on Wednesday, late morning, Earlier today, the Ivy League put out a statement about the possibility of a fall 2020, and they're going to make a decision in about a week on what they do with that. I talked to a bunch of coaches around the conference in the last 24 hours, and many of them, most of the ones I talked to, see playing in the spring as a more sensible option. Now, there's obviously some logistical hurdles that involve in scheduling for them in terms of facilities and things. But one thing, the reason why I use the word term red herring is just the Ivy League is in a unique situation in that, as one coach said, it was like, we're not a revenue sport here. And because we're in the Ivy League, we don't go to a playoff. So they are in a very unique situation. We'll see where this is all going, because I felt like the conversation about maybe playing, having the 2021 season happen in the spring was something that was kicked around a lot maybe 2 months ago, and then it kind of went away. And one thing I feel like has kind of happened is a lot of the stuff that we've heard and that has been written about maybe from 2 months ago has kind of cycled back. I'm not, you know, it's just kind of where we're at right now, and you just kind of got your fingers crossed and see where we're at. And one thing that I feel like from the coaches I've talked to is I've heard a little bit is, you know, we thought by the end of June we would know a lot more. And the people I've talked to say, were the coaches I've talked to say, you know, I don't know if we know really much more than we at this point. And that has added to a lot of concern. And I would just leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, I think when at the time that the decisions were made to send the athletes back to campus, which would have been late May, the whole thing was trending in the right direction, right? So, you know, when we were back in March or early April talking about this, I guess I naively assumed that it would peak and then it would go back down. And, you know, there was talk of a fall second wave, but I certainly didn't think we'd be sitting here July 1st and the numbers are higher than they've ever been. And so that's really the game changer here is they need to start thinking about, well, what if that's still the case a month from now when teams are supposed to start training camp?
Well, the challenge too that I've heard from Stu, from the coaches I've talked to, is they're not doing football stuff right now. We're just talking about them weightlifting in small groups and having some numbers. What's going to happen when it's actually football with the numbers and cases going up? I think there's a lot of contingencies and protocols that still need to be sorted out. If you're going to play an opponent in your non-conference, let's say that maybe isn't testing the way your school is, does that mean that smaller school would then be required to spend some of the money that it is getting from playing this game and use some of that on ramping up its testing? You know, it depends on who you talk to around the sport. I mean, I talked to somebody high up at a Power 5 school, goes, I'm not sure that's going to be the answer people are going to want to hear, because some of those schools may say, we already spent that money. We don't have that. And maybe those games then might not happen. I mean, right now it's still a whole lot of TBD.
It's a lot of things that if this were a professional league, if there was an Adam Silver or Roger Goodell, they would be drafting an 180-page document right now specifying all of those things you're talking about. This is how often you will test. This is how it'll be paid for. But this being college athletics, it's just left to the individual schools and the individual conferences. And the fact that 2 months from the first games, we don't have those answers yet is pretty troubling. So to what you brought up earlier about spring football, you know, I understand why nobody wants to go there yet, but my understanding about the commissioners is like they considered that early on and then they just kind of put it on the back burner. I would recommend they bring it back out closer to the front burner, because I think your best case scenario right now, your best case scenario is that we're going to play a season in the fall and there will be some, and just go into it knowing that some games are going to get canceled and it's possible it'll get so bad that they'll have to shut the season down and pick it back up later. So what's preferable, taking that chance or saying, let's put the thing on pause and come up with a plan to play it starting in February with the hopes that there will be a vaccine by then, or if not a vaccine, a more effective treatment, or we'll just have a lot more data that says, hey, this is almost no risk to 18 to 22 year olds, or any number of things that could happen between now and then. So, you know, we've had a lot of time. It's there's been what, March, April, three and a half months to figure all this stuff out. And I just don't know that they have many answers, more answers to your point, than they did in mid-March. So it'll be an interesting couple months, to say the least. It's certainly a weird position to be in for our sake, where we're, the season's still start coming, so we're still previewing the season, we're still talking about the season, but there's also this whole issue of, is there going to be a season? So I'm just glad we have a guest on today who we don't need to ask about COVID testing or anything of that nature. I wasn't able to make the interview, but I've heard it. It's a great interview, Bruce. Here is Bruce talking with Bucky Brooks.
And now we're pleased to be joined by our guest today. He is Bucky Brooks, a former NFL player, as well as an NFL scout, who is now really one of the best draft analysts out there. He works for NFL Network, and you'll also see him sometimes on FS1 as well. And he does his own podcast, which is really one of the best, one of the few I feel like is a staple for me, the Move the Sticks podcast with our other friend, Daniel Jeremiah. Bucky, it's great to have you on the Audible today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Bruce.
All right, so I want to get to, there's a bunch of stuff I want to get to you with, but I feel like probably as much as anybody I know, along with Daniel, you are so deep into, not just on the personnel scouting side when it comes to college players, but you see these guys coming up through the opening as a high school coach in Southern California. So you have a really, really unique perspective, in addition to having been obviously a really good player yourself. So I want to start with this. One of the things that you guys talked about on your podcast, and it's somebody I've written about at The Athletic a month or two ago, is Trey Lance, the quarterback at North Dakota State, who just had an amazing redshirt freshman season. Tell our listeners what you think of him from having studied him on film compared to some of the other more high-profile quarterbacks that are going to be expected to be in the 2021 draft.
All right, Bruce. So it's interesting that we're having this conversation today, because yesterday I had an opportunity to talk to the Elite 11 camp counselors. And so it was Trey Lance was part of that, Jamie Newman, Justin Fields. And so we were just able to begin to just the process of like, hey, what am I thinking about going forward? What is it going to be like this next year or two as I'm getting ready for the NFL? And I'll say this about Trey Lance and all those guys. Like, the thing that is most impressive to me about Trey Lance is he, when you watch him play, his poise really stands out. He never looks like the game is too big for him. And so for a guy who was a redshirt freshman, having the first opportunity to play, to carry on the tradition that has been well established at North Dakota State, that was impressive. But then when you really dig into his game, I mean, you're talking about a rock-solid prospect, very good arm talent, good athlete, a dual-threat guy who I think his game just kind of translates to any system, meaning you put him in the spread, you can run the quarterback design run with the read option stuff, you can put him under center, he can do the stuff that you see Jimmy Garoppolo and Kirk Cousins do in the Shanahan-type system. I just think he works really well, and I think the more that we get down the line, more scouts and coaches and coordinators are going to look at him and say, man, this is the one guy that can do any and everything that we want to do offensively. And even though he doesn't play at like the highest level, we've seen Carson Wentz come out and play at an MVP level. We've seen Eastern Stick stay on an NFL squad. I think he is going to have an opportunity to be a guy that is in that conversation when we talk about Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence, if they do come out.
In terms of a skill set wise, now obviously we've seen quite a bit of body of work from Trevor Lawrence, having played two really long seasons because of their runs in the playoff. Justin Fields, not as much, but had a, you know, a spectacular first year. How much do you weigh in the stage those guys play on, as well as maybe the talent that's around him? I mean, look, Ohio State has what we think is going to be a great group of receivers around Justin Fields in 2020. It's not to say that a Trey Lance, who it sounds like he may have a first round offensive lineman that he plays with at North Dakota State, and they certainly have upper level talent there. But how much do scouts weigh in what you're playing with, as opposed to just, you know, kind of putting together their whole assessment of a prospect?
You know, it's tough, because that's the debate. That's the debate when you're looking at a guy that comes from outside of like a Power Five school, or outside of like the top level. You wonder, okay, how much of this could be done if he's playing at Ohio State against another team that is loaded? Like, would he benefit from having A-level players around them? Would it impact his performance if he was playing against A-level talent each and every week? I think what you have to do, though, you have to stay true to the traits and the things that he displays. And when I look at Trey Lance, I think his traits transfer because I see him run. I see him run those things, and I think he runs with power and explosiveness. I see him throw, and I see him throw with touch timing and anticipation. And it's easy for me to project him in certain systems because he already does some of those things that those systems will require. You're going to hear me reference the Shanahan system a few times because when I look at him, it is very reminiscent to me of Jimmy Garoppolo. Jimmy Garoppolo at Eastern Illinois, watching Jimmy Garoppolo play for the San Francisco 49ers, I see things that remind me of Jimmy Garoppolo having that success. And so with Trey Lance, I think what every coordinator and coach would tell you is, I want a quarterback who is athletic. I don't necessarily want an athlete playing quarterback. I want a quarterback who is a proven, polished quarterback that can make throws inside and outside the pocket, but also gives me the added dimension of, hey, let's add some quarterback run. Let's do some zone read stuff. Hey, he can make a play when things break down. Trey Lance can do those things. And so I think that's why you're hearing so many people that are excited about his prospects, because you typically don't see this kind of player at that level playing this well this soon.
I'm curious. One of the things that's come up a lot, especially with the COVID debate that is going on, not a debate, but just situation that is impacting everything and certainly college football, is if there was a season that got pushed back to the spring of 2021, one of the things that's come up is, well, what do you do if you're a Trevor Lawrence or a Justin Fields, one of these guys who has looked at as a lock first round pick with the combine being, I'm sure, would it be moved back? Would the NFL draft be moved back? How would it balance? My thought on this is that there's probably only about 15 guys who probably would be seen as likely lock first round picks who might say it's in my best interest to sit out and just sit on what everybody has on film of me already. That doesn't mean there wouldn't be people in their ears, whether it's agents or not, saying, hey, you should probably sit out and just get ready for the draft. How do you think that would play out, knowing the NFL scouting community and the timetable that we're talking about, as well as how people evaluate prospects? Do you think a lot of players would end up sitting out if it was a spring season?
You know, I think that's a very interesting question and situation and scenario. And I think it's one of those things that internally NFL scouts have to already talk about. Like, how do we handle if the college season doesn't go off as scheduled and it is pushed back into the spring? How does that change the way that we evaluate? How do we rank players and the like? I think from a draft standpoint, like talking about the team side first, I think what you would get if the season was pushed into the winter, let's just say it was a January start and it ended in March, and let's just say they continue to have the draft at the end of April or early May, I think you would see the purest draft that we have seen in terms of players being evaluated for how they played and not being impacted by the combine and the pro day workouts and those things. I think you would probably have a better sense of the draft being as accurate to a player's playing ability that we've seen. Now, from a player standpoint, I think it's tricky, right? Because if you're Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence and those guys, and you're thinking, man, if I play in the spring and let's just say some catastrophic happens, what does that do to my draft status? If I play in the spring, are teams going to view me differently because I don't have the opportunity to get on the pro day circuit? I don't have the opportunity to get with the quarterback gurus and kind of tighten up some of the things that may pop up to help me look my best when they are really around and I'm able to talk to them and do those things or whatever. I think with Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence and those, I don't think it would impact them whether they played or not. And I probably shouldn't say that out loud, but I really don't think it would impact it. I think there is enough on Trevor Lawrence in particular that, look, you either feel good about him or you don't. Like, there'll be some nitpicking this year because that's what we do. You have more time to kind of dig into him. And I think with Justin Fields, like, Justin Fields may be a bit of a one-year player because of the one start at Ohio State, but man, he was a starter for the entire season. So you could go and look through those games and get a sense of who he is. And before People talk about, well, yeah, but that's not enough film. I'll just harken back to Mitchell Trubisky was drafted off of like 13 or 14 games of film at North Carolina and went second overall. And we can say that it's been up or down for him throughout his career. But at one point, he was a Pro Bowl player. He led the Chicago Bears to the playoffs. And so there's a scarcity of A-level players at the quarterback position in the National Football League. I think those guys will get a pass. Now, some of the other position players, it may be a little harder to say definitively that those guys' draft statuses wouldn't be impacted by not playing. But I do know for those quarterbacks will go and they would go high regardless of whether they played or not.
Who are some guys who you've seen? You mentioned a couple of the quarterbacks so far, but who are some other guys that have kind of popped for you that you're excited, you would be excited to see play, whether at some point this year, whether it's in the spring or certainly in the fall?
Well, I mean, like the guy who was a surprise guy to stay in was Travis Etienne from Clemson. There was some conversation that he could have been the first one to go if he had come out, just based on, like, everyone knows about the speed and explosiveness. He's kind of a one-cut runner downhill, has the ability to take it to distance, but I think people are really impressed with what he can do in the passing game. We have seen him with those slip screens and flare screens and swing screens at Clemson make big things, big plays happen. And I think as he gets more exposure to the passing game, his value will continue to rise. The linebacker from Penn State, Michael Parsons, has been someone that people are really intrigued and fascinated about. Like, he's big, he's physical, he's fast, he plays with an edge. He has the ability to get to the quarterback. He is kind of the rugged linebacker that everyone is kind of looking for, a tone setter. Obviously, I'm kind of close to the flame, having been around him at the opening at Elite 11, seeing him run around and kind of watch him make his way. But I'll say this, like, he is a dominant player with the pads on, and there are a lot of people that are excited about them. And then the final guy, like the left tackle from Oregon, Penei Sewell. I think this was telling. When I was interviewing Marlon Davidson from Auburn at the Combine, I was asking him, like, a generic question. We always, as scouts, you always ask people, like, hey, who are the best guys that you played against? Because a lot of times players will take you to the water. And so I'm thinking he's going to say, hey, Jedrick Wills or Andrew Thomas or something. He was like, oh, the kid at Oregon is a monster. I was like, who are you talking about? And so he tells me, because it was kind of my first exposure on a higher level, like, oh, and he was like, man, that guy has it all. He's physical, he's tough, he's relentless, he has a high motor, he'll finish plays, he'll do those things. And so coming from the SEC and Auburn in particular, where you see Davidson, you saw Derrick Brown, and the level of physicality and toughness that they displayed, because you just don't see defensive linemen play the way that they played, for them to tip their hat to him, that's when I was like, oh, okay, I need to pay close attention to him, because if he has the goods, he is one of those guys that we will talk about very, very early in the draft.
Bucky, I wanted to ask you, so I talked to you for a story that we ran on The Athletic earlier this week about the chess guy, Seth Mikowski, who he just pops up in a lot of places now. He was Deshaun Watson's guy and Dwayne Haskins' guy, and Sean Clifford at Penn State is working with him, and, you know, Justin Fields work with him, and he's just a lot of people. So you had an interesting, I thought, experience with him. Just you were coaching at the opening, and take me through how you kind of connected with Seth Mikowski, who, by the way, as we said in the story, had never seen a football game or never watched one until the 2018. So it's not like he's the typical guy who is around the football space.
So my interactions with Seth really happened at the opening. And what was fascinating about the interaction was it was something that was unexpected. I had never played chess. I didn't know who Seth was. I knew he was hanging around watching. He had a little black notebook around him. And I watched him give lessons to the quarterbacks. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I'm trying to figure out how this works, but it's interesting. But later that night in the lobby at the hotel, I'm watching Quincy Avery and George Whitfield have a chess game. And Seth is kind of watching from afar and just kind of noticing and doing some things or whatever. But then some of the quarterbacks come down and they sit, and C.J. Stroud, who's the quarterback on our team, he's there, and he's kind of getting in, and Seth is trying to teach him a move and an opening move that is aggressive, but is one that requires a little forethought and planning and being able to really assess what is going on the board. And C.J. finally gets it, and you see the light come on, and you see him kind of play with a level of aggressiveness and assertiveness and confidence that you're like, wow, this is impressive for a guy who hasn't played much. But then Seth leaves and CJ's teammates come and he's explaining to them the game. And the passion with which he talked about the game resonated with me because I was like, man, like what does Seth do to unlock it? So then in my conversation with Seth, we're talking about chess and he's just talking about like, look, man, this game is just kind of a vehicle for me to unlock some things that quarterbacks can use to help them become better. Like it's thinking the game, thinking the pre-snap process, but being aggressive when you approach it. So he says, hey, why don't I teach you the game? So we're sitting down and we're playing and we're going back and forth. And he said two things that resonated with me. And I kind of have this band that he gave me. It's threats and attacks. And when I tell you this story, it's going to make sense. He says, whenever you're on the chessboard, when you're looking, before you put your hand on the piece, look at where the potential threats are. Where are you in danger? Who could attack you? Who could take your most pivotal pieces? And then the next thing that you do is attack the threats. And I was like, okay. He said, because Buck, like this is how you win. Like when you are on the offensive, you always put people in a retreating situation. He said, those are the things that I teach quarterbacks. Come to the line of scrimmage, understand what you see, see the coverage, where could I be attacked at, where are they vulnerable, let's go attack the vulnerability. And so when we have heard Deshaun Watson so eloquently talk about things in pressers, I know that he's been influenced by Seth because Deshaun's game has gone to another level because he clearly understands what the defense is doing to him, but he has become an aggressive assassin when it comes to attacking it. And so Seth unlocks that potential in quarterbacks. That's why he's one of the most sought after people right now.
Yeah. I thought that what you said kind of blew me away, especially as, you know, as people see in the story, just as it related to your own playing career, as a guy who was converted from receiver to DB in the NFL. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, so you are a proud Tar Heel. You played for Mac Brown. For a lot of people who saw Mac get the job early on at North Carolina the second time when he went back there, I think we had in our mind the way things kind of fizzled out at Texas. Well, as we're taping this, a day after Mac Brown just landed a huge five-star defensive back, Tony Grimes, and now he has a top three ranked recruiting class. Are you at all surprised at what Mac is doing in his second act in Chapel Hill, or is this kind of what you expected?
It's really what I expected, Bruce, and here's why it's what I expected. When Coach Brown was dismissed from Texas, one, I felt like he kind of got like a raw deal based on the level of play that he brought Texas football to. The number of 10-win seasons that it had under his watch, the fact that they played for two national championships, even though it went south for a little bit at the end of his tenure. And look, due to some of the decisions that they made, like recruiting-wise, they didn't get it done. I still thought, look, man, at the time of the BCS, there were only a handful of guys that were winning the title. It was Urban Meyer, it was Nick Saban, and it was Coach Brown. Like, those were the guys that were in the conversation. And so I felt like he never was appreciated for the level of greatness and excellence that he delivered. So when he came back to North Carolina after the five-year layoff and talking to him, I knew that he was motivated to do it a little differently this time around. But I also knew that he knew the recipe and the formula for being able to get it done in North Carolina. And what we have seen in recruiting, he is doing what he did the first go-round. I was in his second recruiting class in North Carolina, and the one thing that he always talked about was, we have to put a fence around the state. We cannot let our best players leave the state. And when you look, North Carolina and South Carolina, but North Carolina has had a number of players that have not only gone on to big schools, but have gone on to the National Football League. Those guys weren't staying at North Carolina. And so North Carolina has a saying now where they talk about the best from North Carolina play at Carolina. And so you're seeing him kind of put a fence around that. The other thing is, when you go back and look at when Carolina has been great, Carolina has been great when they have had a pipeline to that Virginia Beach Tidewater area. When they are connected to that region, Lawrence Taylor, Dre Bly, Ronald Curry, those guys from that area, when they come to North Carolina, Carolina goes from good to great. So I knew that he would try and reestablish himself in that area. And then the final piece was North Carolina has never had kind of like the marquee quarterback. And I will talk about like Mitchell Trubisky and Marquise Williams. They were great for what they did. But in terms of, hey, everyone knows that this is a five-star quarterback. So when they were able to flip Sam Howell at the 11th hour, that was a big get, because getting a big time quarterback now enables you to be able to get playmakers and pass catchers, because they want to play with somebody who has an opportunity to go to the next level. Having been around Sam Howell at Elite 11, like, I've seen his game and how he can resonate and pop, and it's really pop. So now he is a smooth and savvy recruiter. He was able to sell recruits last year on hope and optimism. Well, now, because they won some games and they took Clemson to the wire, he is now able to sell them on, hey, look, you're either with us or against us. We're going to win. And so you have to make a decision where you want to be on board or not. And you're beginning to see the recruits come in droves. I think this is really the foundation of what could be a very nice run, even though he's up in age. I think Carolina is set up to be a team that we have to talk about for a while.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We'll see if he, how much that impacts also when you say that 757 area code, where it's like, that's Virginia Tech's, you know, it's got to be their home base. And certainly, you know, some of the recruiting, look, one of the guys you know really well, Dexter Lawrence, ended up going to Clemson.
Yeah.
You know, maybe in a different age, this guy maybe stays in state.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest part of it. Like, and he has said this privately and publicly. He has said, at Carolina, you don't have to go outside of North Carolina, South Carolina, and then that little area in Virginia. Like, you can get everything that you need right there. The recruits that come from outside of those areas, they need to be dudes. They need to be five-star players, guys that are immediate impact players. And so what he has done, and I knew early on when they got there, they made a concerted effort to go see every high school in the state to make sure that they had a presence there, and that he reconnected with all of the old high school coaches that were a big part of kind of funneling the program or fueling the program during his first go-round. And so when he reconnected and opened the doors and brought the high school coaches back and reestablished those relationships, more high school coaches were comfortable nudging their players to go towards North Carolina. And then when you saw the facility upgrades, putting the field turf in, some of the other things that they're doing around the program, and really making the program about the players, it is now kind of fun to go to North Carolina. And for all of the things that Clemson offers, Carolina can offer the same things. The same way that Dabo is connected to his players and you feel that sense of family, North Carolina can create, and they are creating, those similar things. And they know, look, Clemson is the team that they want to get to. Clemson has the bullseye on their back, and they're trying to put themselves in a situation where each and every year at the end of the season in the ACC title game, it's North Carolina versus Clemson for the chip. If they can do that, I think Tar Heel fans all over will be excited.
Yeah, it's definitely made North Carolina relevant again. Bucky, it's always great to talk to you. Learn a lot every time I do. Thanks for joining us on the Audible, and I would encourage people to follow you on Twitter at Bucky Brooks, and as well as check out the podcast you and Daniel Jeremiah do, Move the Sticks. It's always a great listen.
Hey, thanks so much, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Thanks.
All right, we appreciate Bucky for joining us on the Audible today. And now we're going to get to your questions. As always, you can write us at theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Let's do our first question. Is from Mark Weaver in Pittsburgh. The Big 12 and the Pac-12 have not had national championships since USC and Texas in the mid-aughts. The Big 3 of Clemson, Bama, Ohio State don't seem to be going away. Give us some of your famous percentages of what happens first. Okay, Stu, here are the things we're going to have you assess. A Big 12 champion national champ happens first, a Pac-12 national championship, or the elimination or combination of these conferences during a realignment. God, I know you love realignments too.
Yeah, and that third one is something I've myself have brought up at times, so it's not like I consider that to be a completely... So wait, do these percentages have to add up to 100? Or no, they don't, right? Okay. All right, a Big 12 national champion. To me, of the three, I think that's what I'm going to go with first, because they already have a program in Oklahoma that has made the playoff repeatedly. They have another program in Texas that hasn't gotten to that level yet, but by all indicators recruits the amount of talent you would need to do that. Whereas I think the Pac-12 has like, I don't know, one and a half that fit that bill in Oregon and possibly USC. All right, so Big 12, national champion. Of that's the thing that happens first, 30%? What about you?
I feel like there's two realistic shots, which are the traditional ones, Oklahoma and Texas. I mean, what I'm seeing this comes down to is basically, do I have more confidence in Alex Grinch can help upgrade the talent level on that side of the ball to be a national title team? Or do I feel like Oregon's offense will get pass game will grow enough where that can be a national title team? That's how I'm like kind of factoring in. I just feel like maybe Oklahoma is closer. So I would lean towards the number you said. I would say it's like, to me, 30% on Big 12, maybe 20% on Pac 12. And then I would say 10% on the realignment possibility.
But wait, I think it does have to add up to 100%. Cause the question is, which of these things happens first? So one of these things has to happen first, right?
Okay, so, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah. So, all right, okay. I'm going to say 50% Big 12, 35% Pac-12, 15% realignment.
That's pretty close to what I was going to say. The realignment idea is actually something that I think they should explore, but it's so bold and radical, it's hard for me to put much of a high number on it. I would actually go 50% Big 12, 40% Pac-12, 10% massive realignment.
Okay.
So we're pretty locked in there.
All right, Stu, the next question is from Ben in Charlotte. Now that John Swofford is stepping down in 2021, how would you evaluate his time as commissioner? Who do you think would be good or a leading candidate to replace him? Stu, weigh in.
Yeah, it's interesting. Commissioners are just kind of generally unpopular. Like, there were even Big Ten fans who didn't like Jim Delaney, even though he did so much for that conference. And I saw the same thing in the comments to the story I wrote when Swofford retired, ACC fans grumbling about him. I think that he doesn't get enough credit for the fact that if you go back to the early 2000s, the Big East and the ACC were basically on equal terms football-wise. If anything, the Big East might have been a little bit more highly regarded because that was when Miami was at its absolute peak and Virginia Tech had played in the, I mean, it's like three of the first five BCS title games, the Big East had a team in it. So, and then he made the bold move and stole Miami away from them and Virginia Tech, and it's never been the same since. That was the first step toward making them a legit football conference, you know, further expanding on that later on, the relationship with Notre Dame, you know, the ACC is on much, and the Big East eventually crumbled. The ACC became solidly a Power Five conference. It's not certainly viewed as the Big Ten and the SEC, but it's a very stable, you know, conference that has a program that's won two national championships recently, and then Florida State not long before that. So I think he deserves a ton of credit for that. You know, hasn't been perfect. You know, I do think he made a mistake locking them into a 20-year television deal with ESPN. It's gonna, you know, he won't have to worry about it, but his successor may have to deal with the fact that they're going to fall very far behind in revenue if they don't figure out a way to get out of that. But I think he deserves a lot of credit. In terms of a replacement, Matt Fortuna wrote a great article about that for our site. I think that the thinking right now is that it may be one of the current presidents in the ACC that's going to try to make a play for that job, most notably Jim Clements, the president at Clemson. There are certainly people in that office now that I think could do the job. I know you and I are biased on this, but Amy Akola, who we've dealt with for years and years on the media side, you know, has been working hand in hand with John Swofford for a long time, would absolutely be a good candidate to be the ACC commissioner. But, you know, the Big Ten really threw a curveball with Kevin Warren. Everybody thought it was going to be either Jim Phillips, the Northwestern AD, or you know, one of the people working for Jim Delaney in the Big Ten office, and then they just went completely outside of the box with Kevin Warren. Nobody even outside of Minnesota or outside the NFL knew who he was. And I think that makes it harder to handicap the ACC. They might not do, those presidents might opt to do something less conventional than promoting one of their ADs or promoting somebody on the staff.
It's also going to be a challenging time going forward just because of the financial issues that are coming from the pandemic that we're dealing with. And you have a lot of other issues.
NIL.
Have come to NIL, especially, you know, we had Bubba Cunningham, the North Carolina AD, on this podcast probably a month ago. And there's a lot of differing opinions on how that stuff is going to sort out, to say the least.
I think Swofford was much more embracing of NIL than two of his two most, you know,
leading ADs.
Leading the ADs of the programs that probably hold the most clout in that conference. Jim Schilander, Bruce and Stu, is it crazy to suggest that there has been a raft of disappointing quarterbacks from high-level high school programs lately? And I define such a program as one that produces multiple Power 5 players in every senior class. It's typically a private school. The most obvious case is Tate Martell, going from winning the mythical high school national title at Bishop Gorman in Vegas to switching positions at his second school, to someone like Shea Patterson, who never seemed to live up to the hype out of IMG Academy, or even, JT Daniels having less success than projected coming from modern day. Obviously, each case is different, but does having super high-level talent at the high school level perhaps give these quarterbacks a higher projected ceiling than their talent warrants?
I think it absolutely does. I mean, those examples you're talking about were guys who played with elite talent. I remember seeing Tate Martell with a bunch of his teammates. I don't know, he must have been maybe 15 at the time, maybe around, or maybe 16, but really good receivers. And I think that makes such an impact of who the guys you're playing with. I mean, all those examples that Jim pointed out are very true. I mean, you can look and see some of these things. Let's not say those guys didn't have good individual attributes, but I think when it comes to the recruiting process, that's the stuff that gets people's attention. Also, there is a factor of, hey, if we sign this guy, then we may be able to get an in with his receivers or his teammates, and that adds to the appeal on them. I think conversely, you'll every once in a while hear about a player who is like, oh yeah, he ran a wing T in high school, or he did this, or the talent was really bad around him. And so that's often the guys who kind of get lost in the shuffle, is especially when it comes to that position, because I think it's really hard for guys to shine if they're playing with subpar talent around them. And I think that's just a reality with a very nuanced position to begin with.
How much also do you think there's a case of, there's been such a long line at this point, certainly at modern day, but also some of those other Southern California schools where, you know, if you're good enough to become the starting quarterback at that school, then it's like assumed that you're going to be a high level Power 5 quarterback. Like, it's just, is their recruiting ranking, regardless of what the tape says, is their recruiting ranking unduly bumped up just because of the legacy of that position at that school?
Well, I think it is. But look, I mean, and it's probably not fair to lean on JT Daniels too much at this stage of his career. But like, I mean, he's clearly a upper level Power 5 kind of talent. It's not like he doesn't belong there. I think the questions are going to be, when you get anointed as a big 5-star guy, it's like then people are thinking, okay, this is the pick of the draft. This is like, you know, has first pick of the draft kind of talent. And I think that's the part where, you know, that wasn't what Pat Mahomes was playing with in East Texas when he was in high school necessarily. Or those, you know, there's certain guys who maybe didn't have that kind of, where you have a bunch of other guys you play with, you're getting recruited. Here's an example that, and it popped into my head just as we're talking. So, I don't know, it was maybe a week ago, like I was flipping through the dial and it's just like, you know, just trying to find something on TV. And one of the regional Fox Sports sites had a game from 2001. And it was a 2001 Thousand Oaks against, I forgot the team they played, but Thousand Oaks, I have a buddy who was a really good college player at Colorado State and then played in the NFL for probably 5 years as slot receiver, Dave Anderson. And I was like, oh, that's probably Dave's team. Well, Dave's high school quarterback was actually the big recruit. Dave's high school quarterback was Ben Olsen. And for most of our listeners, you know, they probably remember him, but if you're younger, maybe you don't. Ben Olsen was a 5-star recruit, big arm, pretty athletic, but really big arm, great size. Started out at BYU and then went to UCLA and didn't have a great college career production-wise. But when you watch this game, Dave dominated. I mean, he ran for a touchdown. He had a punt return for a touchdown, and he had a long reception. I mean, he was by far the best player on the field. And from that game, he finally got an offer from Colorado State. And I'm saying that was the other receiver was Corey Mazza, who was a great player in the Ivy League, was a big receiver who ended up there. And so those were Ben Olsen's receivers. And I'm not saying Ben Olsen didn't deserve any of the hype, but all the hype actually went to the quarterback, where it turned out the receivers were actually, especially one of them, was probably the guy who should have gotten more of the hype. And so it's kind of interesting to see how that dynamic can work, because the quarterback's the one that gets the star treatment usually.
How was the, when you said there was a game on from 2001, it threw me for a loop when you revealed that it was a high school game. How was the production level of a TV broadcast of a high school game from 2001?
Well, it was in low def, which obviously is jarring. The weird part of this, and now, like, and full disclosure, my wife knows Dave, so she was like not riveted to it, but we're watching, and I have no idea that he dominates the game. I just know he's in the game, you know, and I'm expecting him to, you know, do stuff. But like at halftime, what I didn't know was Petros, who I guess it was his first season working for Fox, but this is, he was not doing the broadcast, but Petros did a halftime interview with Dave, like it was a Skype piece where I guess they were interviewing, you know, the conversation happened in both of their apartments and looking back. So it was, again, I think if you were a big Southern California high school football fan, you probably were interested. Or if you know one of these two people, you were probably interested. And otherwise, you flipped on. Now, what was really random was, like, I want to say there's like three media members who were also on that team at Thousand Oaks, like John Gold, who used to cover UCLA and as a sports writer was like a backup offensive lineman, and Jonas Knox, who is a Brady Quinn's co-host, was like a backup offensive lineman on that team too. So you just had like some other people chiming in as they're watching this game, in real time. So it was just kind of interesting.
By the way, while we were doing this, I looked up, I was trying to figure out the whole pipeline of Bishop Gorman quarterbacks recently, with certainly in Tate Martell's the headliner, but also Dorian Thompson Robinson, and I know there's a kid who's going to Penn State, but
Anu was there.
Yeah, so that's right. So the Las Vegas Sun on December 31st, 2019 did an all Vegas decade team. Tate Martell was the quarterback for this team. Martell, one could argue, is the greatest high school player in Las Vegas history. That's going to be one of these ESPN documentaries at one point. How on earth he went from that to Miami receiver?
Look, I mean, you can be a great high school player, and it may not translate into college. I mean, it is a kind of a different game. So, I mean, I think one of the things that you run the risk of is, like, for example, you'll see somebody who was a great college player and they don't have anywhere near the same success. You know, it doesn't invalidate Tim Tebow's career at Florida, certainly, because he, you know, didn't,
right,
you know, be a star quarterback in the NFL or anything.
Yeah, plenty of five-star high school quarterbacks have not come close to living up to that. So I'm not saying like Tate Martell is the only one. It's just the whole persona he cultivated, and, you know, the Ohio State to Miami. Like, you would think at some point he would at least be, like, when I say, usually I mean the five-star quarterbacks, they didn't live up to the hype, but they did at least become a starting college quarterback. It's not looking like that's going to happen for Tate. Finally, Andrew, he comes back. This is a double header question, or a sequel to his question from last week. Remember, we had the question last mm-hmm. week about examples of hot seat coaches who you felt were let go too early. This week, his question is about examples of where you felt coaches made a mistake by leaving for another job, either because it was a bad fit or, more importantly, the coach had potential to really build something special by staying where he was. Here are his examples. Brett Bielema going from Wisconsin to Arkansas. Rich Rod going from West Virginia to Michigan. Sark, going from Washington to USC, Jimbo Fisher, Florida State to Texas A&M, Willie Taggart, Oregon to Florida State. This Mike Riley one, I would only focus on the last part, Oregon State to Nebraska.
Okay, so let's take some of these. I would agree with most of them. Now, some of the behind-the-scenes circumstances, I don't know how comfortable Brett Bielema wanted to stay at Wisconsin, you know, at that point with how everything was going. I obviously had way more success there and had it rolling than he did at Arkansas. Rich Rod, I just think he went into a really super weird transition where he just didn't seem like he fit there. Sark is the one that I looked at that and I said, you know, Sark had personal issues that just escalated, and I imagine those issues would have surfaced and become problematic wherever he would have been coaching at that point. The one I looked at that was different, I don't know if I agree with the Jimbo Fisher, because I felt like Jimbo Fisher,
it's too soon to say on that one.
It is, and also I feel like Jimbo was really running, had already started to like backslide there. You know, they started to really struggle in his last year and a half there. I think you saw some of the remnants of that with what Willie Taggart took over on the roster. With Willie Taggart taking Florida State, that was his dream job. He was closer to his family. I mean, I think from conversations I had before that was even in the mix, I knew that how he felt about Florida State, because he hadn't been shy about talking about, you know, his family connections and things like that. So I kind of get why he did that. You know, the one I don't have a great answer on or don't feel is, you know, if you were to ask Brett Bielema about it, I mean, I was surprised he didn't get it going at Arkansas. I really was.
Brett Bielema is my answer. Not to say he should have stayed at Wisconsin for the rest of his life, but, I mean, he left when he had it really rolling. And he picked a job. And look, I don't know if he would have ever gotten offered the Georgia job or something like that. But the whole flaw in that decision is that he thought he could take the Wisconsin system and run it in the SEC at a program that doesn't recruit at the level of most of the teams that they play each week. So, you know, I think at Wisconsin, that formula works because you are as talented or more talented than all but a couple teams in the conference. And it's, look, if you look back at Wisconsin's record, for all its success, it still doesn't have a great record against Ohio State, because that's the one team that just has a decided talent advantage throughout this time. Whereas in the SEC, LSU, Alabama, Auburn, you know, the teams in the East that they would play, like there was hardly any programs. I mean, basically the only programs where they were matching up were probably, and that was also when Hugh Freeze was recruiting at a very high level at Ole Miss. So I just think he probably realized pretty quickly that he couldn't just out-tough the other teams in that division, and the recruiting wasn't good, and then he tried to change things up at the end, and it didn't work. So if he had stayed at Wisconsin, would he have kept winning Big Ten titles frequently? I don't know for sure, but I don't know. I think he just kind of miscalculated there.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. That was the one, you know, like, there's been books written about the Rich Rod tenure at Michigan, so I don't know if we need to go further into that.
I still think that was the right choice. It just didn't, it turned out to be a bad fit, but, I mean, 10 out of 10 guys are going to make that same decision. Michigan's one of those jobs that if they offer it to you, you're going to take it.
Yeah, look, and I wonder if he was there longer, as I said last week. I mean, Brady Hoke came in and won and did a really good job, but won a lot of games with the talent Rich Rod had brought in there.
An interesting one is Taggart. Like, what would have happened if he'd stayed at Oregon? We never really got a sense. I mean, Cristobal is doing great now. Could Willie Taggart have achieved the same thing? Or would I don't know, would he be getting run out of Oregon by now the way he was run out of Florida State? There's just no way to know.
Yeah, I mean, look, in a lot of ways, I think he took over a better situation of a team that didn't have as much of a winning track record. I mean, he at least inherited a pretty good quarterback, and certainly Mario built off of what what he did there and kind of took some of Willie's recruiting model and certainly took what he had learned in the SEC at Alabama, and has just been thriving. So it's interesting.
If I can throw one more name out there,
mm-hmm.
This wasn't voluntary. I mean, this was somebody who got fired. But when Mark Richt got fired from Georgia, it seemed like a great idea at the time for him to go coach his alma mater at Miami. And they had that one, you know, that one moment in the sun when they started 10-0. But in the end, it ended in pretty spectacularly bad fashion. And, you know, I remember there was a very quick, like, he got fired on a Sunday and the Miami job got offered, and like within 48 or 72 hours, he was coaching Miami. And I don't know, I wish he had taken a little bit of a pause to think about what he was getting into, because I just don't think he was at a... I think now it's pretty obvious that, like, he was no longer at a point in his life where he could be as all-in as you need to be a successful head coach at that level. Now he's living his best life on the ACC network, joking around. He's funny on Twitter now. Like, he's more mellow than we've ever seen him. And I'm thinking maybe that would have been the right course to just start that part of his life 3 years earlier, because ultimately the Miami thing just kind of tarnished his legacy in the end. He had a great run at Georgia, and the Miami thing did not go well.
I think it's hard for coaches who've never been fired when they get fired, and then somebody with a big job, especially one that had appeal to him, says, hey, we like you. And then it's hard to turn that down. Now, in Mark Richt's defense, one thing that I think doesn't show up maybe in his like Wikipedia bio is he helped raise a lot of money for Miami and Miami's football program. And, you know, if you're a Miami football fan, I think you got to appreciate that. And that's something that probably gets lost. It's he helped elevate the program in a way that matters, that is probably more significant at Miami than it would be at a lot of other places that are top 25 programs, just because of the resources were needed, and he helped marshal that. So I do think that should be noted and on his resume.
Fair enough. This is a really good set of questions. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Hope everybody has a great 4th of July weekend, and we'll see you next time. If you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating if you could, too. It helps us get the word out. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can download their music on Spotify or Apple Music. Follow me on Twitter at SL Mandel. Follow Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, what are you waiting for? You can get 40% off an annual subscription by using this link, theathletic.com/theaudible. That's 40% off your subscription to The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.